From the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, KUAR Public Radio brings you Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, the only program on radio today dedicated to the preservation of comparative generational thought, with your host, Phil Marriage. Welcome to the Crossroads of History.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 2013 edition of Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow here in Little Rock. I'm Phil Marriage, your host. I'm really glad you guys can join us here today for a discussion, I think, on a topic that's been really in the news quite a bit lately. It goes hot and cold. We'll hear a lot of stories about this topic, and then it kind of settles down. And then we hear a few more stories, and it always has to do with some news event in this topic. We'll be talking today about sports injuries. But I do want to tell you at the outset of the program, if you'd like to listen to the longer version of our program, all you have to do is go to KUAR.org and click on Programs. We're at the very tail end of that under Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. You'll see a list of several of our programs we've had in the past, and you can just listen to them there in that longer form. As we begin the program today, I want to take you back to October 2nd, 1936. A young fellow by the name of John Allen Adams, he was a junior at Arkadelphia High School. He was in his last football game of the season there with Malvern. He was a running back, and he sat up after a play, and he was tackled from behind in a late hit, forcing him forward and compressing his head into his chest. It paralyzed him from the chest down, and he was carried off the field by his coaches and rushed to the hospital. But back in 1936, it really was a lot different than it is today. He did spend the next 40 years, plus years of his life, confined to a wheelchair apparatus that really looks archaic if you saw the pictures of it. And he was one of the longest living quadriplegics until he died. And he's remembered even today as one of the finest scholars and poets of the Arkadelphia community, having his own bookstore there for many years. And one of our guests, my older generation guest, is Dr. Woody Jolly. I don't know, Dr. Jolly, did you remember the name John Allen Adams?
I really don't. I was in school here from 1960 to 64.
Well, those people that live in the Arkadelphia area in that vicinity who are probably much in that older generation would remember that name. But his injury speaks to the very same thing that we're going to be talking today, as how sports injuries were handled over time compared to now. And I think we'll find a lot of different interesting comments about that. The voice you just heard there was Dr. Woody Jolly. He's a professor at Henderson State University, and he played football and ran track there at Henderson from 1960 through 1964, where they won the AIC championship in his senior year in football. And he received several injuries during his days there at Henderson. One was a broken arm. He had three concussions and three shoulder separations. The first aid for all of these really was done by the coaches, because they didn't really even have trainers back then. Dr. Woody Jolly, thanks for being with us and joining us here today from Arkadelphia.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And then speaking from the middle generation is Sue Carver. She's in the studio with us here today, and she's a physical therapist here at UAMS. Sue Carver, glad to have you here.
Thank you.
And our younger generation perspective is coming from Michael Switlick. He's a certified athletic trainer and the head athletic trainer for UALR Athletics here, and he serves as the primary athletic trainer for men's basketball, cross-country, track and field, and both of the golf teams. So, Michael Switlick, glad to have you here.
It's a pleasure.
Getting into the discussion right away, I do want to begin with you, Dr. Woody Jolly. Going back to your playing days, I guess even before college, where I mentioned those injuries, what are your recollections about sports injuries at that time?
Well, of course, we didn't have the education that coaches are required to take now. All they had was probably a basic course in first aid, and none of them knew anything about training, for that matter, or injuries in particular. And I can remember, you know, just during practices during two-a-days when it was so hot, we weren't even allowed to have water or ice. I can remember my junior year, we were finally allowed to have, we'd get three little cubes of ice is all we could have all during practice. And, of course, it was just wasn't any reason except for the fact that we just weren't educated as to the importance of, or the coaches weren't educated in terms of the importance of hydrating kids and letting them. It's a wonder. I don't know how we all kept from dying from heat stroke back then. And of course, we didn't have the air conditioning like we do now. And I think we were acclimated better to it at that time. But I know even when I got in college, and we had expanded our curriculum for coaches to care and treatment, prevention and treatment of athletic injuries, which got into a little bit more of how to treat injuries, tape ankles and that sort of thing. But, you know, it just wasn't hardly done back in the 50s and 60s.
Now, I do want to ask you one question about the mental attitude, both in the athletes and the coaching staffs, that you were supposed to just be tough and get through things.
That's it was part of the atmosphere and psychology to suck it up and be tough. I can't tell you how many times I've seen coach. In fact, I was been guilty of it when I first started coaching. You didn't know whether a kid was really, really hurt or just faking. We'd go out there many times. It just scares me to death about how I used to tell those kids, come on, get up, you're not hurt, you know. you learn the personality of those kids in practice, and some of them tend to use any kind of ploy to get out of practice or get out of a little tough work, and you do that, and it just scares me to death how many times that I could have really seriously damaged a kid or from an injury by not being more careful.
Did you have much resistance from parents or even the kids themselves, like, hey, coach, this isn't right? Or was it just nobody said anything?
No, I don't think anybody said anything back then. The parents, of course, were not on the practice field most of the time, and most of those kind of things happened on the practice field. But in game-like situations, we always were lucky. I started coaching at Pulaski Heights Junior High School back in 1964-65, and we had a physician on the field all the time during games. But never did we have trainers, never did we have physicians at practice and that kind of stuff. We were just expected to take care of that kind of stuff ourselves, you know.
Well, let me jump over the middle a little bit and go right to Michael. How does it sound different now?
The presence of an athletic trainer, particularly at high school games, is still probably a relatively new evolution. I know when I was playing football here in Little Rock in the late 80s, again, our sideline medical presence was someone's dad who was a doctor or someone's mom who was a nurse. So, I mean, even some of that was still relatively new to me when I was at that point. When I graduated from grad school, that's when, for me, I started getting in, you know, the outreach programs where you work for a sports medicine clinic, whether that was through a, you know, physical therapy department or orthopedic surgeons group, and you went and covered sports. And that was a much more daily regimen for you, you know, checking on student athletes at the high school and also covering home events. Mm-hmm. So I would say even that is still a relatively, from a consistent basis, relatively, it was starting to come around for you when in the 80s, you know, that was starting to come around.
I moved to Little Rock in 1989, and I'm an athletic trainer as well as a physical therapist. So when I came, it was to start a sports medicine practice here. I found out there was only either 3 to 5 certified trainers in the whole state of Arkansas.
And those were probably predominantly at universities, weren't they, probably
right
at that time?
And
yeah.
So we wanted to provide some coverage for the high schools. So I reached out to some of the students at UCA that were there that were certified trainers, and we ended up having 4 or 5 trainers. And we would go out and cover some of the high schools' practices and games. But I was amazed that there was nothing in place because I come from Virginia originally, and they had athletic trainers in the high school. And so it was really surprising to me.
Woody, let me ask you, what was it like when you first saw or felt the pressure to have a trainer involved with sports? Was it something you guys welcomed, or did you question what was going on, or how did it start?
Well, when I came here, I came from Little Rock School District in 1990 down here as chair of the physical education department. We had a hired athletic trainer, and I think Henderson was one, like UCA, one of the first that had a certified athletic trainer, a guy named Terry DeWitt. He's been a pioneer. In fact, he started our academic athletic training program, and now we have probably 25 or 30 student athletic trainers. But Terry was a big part of that, getting it going. And he, like they did at UCA, he'd take his trainees and take them out to the high schools around here, Arkadelphia and Gurdon and Prescott and Malvern, and provide a trainer for them on Friday nights. But, you know, like during the week, they didn't have trainers. The coaches still had to take care of those kind of. But I know now with all these trainers, that's part of their internship. They have to be out and service these schools even during the week. They do internship hours.
So if you were a coach in college, when would you have been taught the college level and you're going to teach on high school level or coach on high school level? When would you have been taught, like, hey, we have to have trainers. We need to do something about training. Is that something, Sue?
I was going to say the National Athletic Trainers Association is not that old. It was first started in 1950. And it wasn't until 1970 that women came into the profession. I think there was, like, at the first meeting, a little over 125 trainers, and now there's 30,000
wow.
plus,
mm-hmm.
and about half of them are women. So probably...
Was that because of Title IX?
I think Title IX was a big push, but I also think as a result of injuries that we saw in football. Like, this is an interesting fact that I found. In 1905, President Roosevelt was threatening to abolish football because of 18 deaths and 159 serious injuries.
Wow.
Because what they used to do is mass tackling, and, you know, the equipment was not as good as it is today. And so also the NC2A was formed to protect athletes and to start organization, but it was very early in its infancy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, I think the NC2A came in 1906. And so in 1950, they were growing and had hired an executive director to manage the programs and stuff. But there was so much corruption in sports early on as well. This was another fact that I found. There was early on one of the basketball championships, they found out that the players were paid off to fix the games. So because of the corruption, you have the NC2A coming in to try and help organize the sports, and then the athletic trainers come in initially with no education. They just had an interest in, you know, sports and wanted to help, and so they'd slap an ice pack on or...
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the book, when we had our 50th anniversary in the NATA, they put out a book that kind of a historical perspective.
Right.
There's a great picture of this guy working on Babe Ruth, and at his feet is a bucket, some towels, and like he's like applying a bag of ice to him.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, I think that's the quintessential thing that people still think of what an athletic trainer is.
Right.
And, you know, we've gone way beyond. I think that's what it was, Beyond the Shoebox or something, was what
right,
this historical
that was the name
perspective
of the book, yeah.
I really feel like we've gone beyond that. You know, especially now with durable goods on the market, it's even beyond just tape and ankles. Well, what we're providing is healthcare. And that's really where the focus has become. We went from being that kind of service provider,
right,
you know, into more of a healthcare. And I think that's too, the NCAA, that's a great point on why that kind of developed, is that the athletic trainers, I think, started seeing these trends and started reporting those things to organizations,
right,
going, we need to do something about this. And so that's where all those rules and regulations on how to hit properly, to avoid, you know, mass tackling, to look at these things. You can even look in hockey, in college hockey. You can't back check like you can in NHL and things of that nature to help protect. So each individual sport has the rules, and a lot of these things have developed because of the presence of athletic trainers treating these things on a daily basis and keeping track of them. So that's the great feedback that we're able to provide because we're on that scene every day.
Right. Well, I think it's a lot better than having coaches decide, because they have a different interest, mm-hmm, you know, than the athletic trainer has. The athletic trainer's there to protect the athlete, and coach wants to win.
Woody Jolly, let me ask you about the injuries I outlined at the beginning of our program here today that you sustained. How have they affected you over the course of your life, and what kind of treatment did you get for your injuries?
It's really remarkable. I can remember the first injury I had here at Henderson. I broke my arm, took the opening kickoff against Arkansas Tech. They ran me under the bench over there, and I got up. My arm was broken right above my wrist. One of the coaches grabbed it, and he was going to pull it back in place. And it just, I went to my knees with pain, you know. But here's what's interesting. Back, like it was, we didn't have trainers. We didn't have anybody back then. And they took the student manager, took me in the car and took me to the hospital at Russellville. And they set my arm. I woke up out there in the hall at Russellville on a gurney with nobody around. Nobody was there. And when I was just left there by myself like that. But the point I'm trying to make is the coach just knew that I just had dislocated my wrist. He's going to pull it back in place. Of course, it was broken up there. But that's the kind of stuff that we just, you know, there wasn't any training as such, per se, for that kind of injury or any kind of injury, really. So he didn't know what to do except just try to pull it back in place.
We hear all the time about knee injuries and this kind of surgery and that kind of surgery. What did they do about knee injuries then?
Well, they pretty much sent them to the doctor. Of course, you know, a knee injury is usually, if it's torn, got a torn ligament or something, it's not cartilage, they're not going to want to be able to walk on it. A player can't get back in the game usually, and the next day they have it x-rayed. And as good as x-rays were back then, you know, it still weren't good enough to tell you. You know, the MRIs are so much better now. But, you know, they have ways of checking those knees now to determine almost immediately whether they've got a torn ligament or not. So it's changed considerably, I think.
Have you had long-lasting conditions from your injuries?
No, I really hadn't. My wrist will ache every once in a while. You know, of course, I'm 71 years old, and it may be just arthritis in it. But, you know, my head injuries, I got knocked out, like I said before, that getting put in the hospital there at Russellville. I got knocked out at opening kickoff one time, took it, and I woke up in the dressing room, in the training room, and on the table by myself. They had just taking me in there and left me, you know. And I guess the trainers, the managers came in there and checked on me every once in a while to make sure I was still breathing. But I woke up at half in there on the table in the dressing room.
Well, Sue Carver, talking about concussions, because that's what we hear in the news a lot, quite a bit now, and mainly, I guess, from pro football, but as it goes into the other areas, as you've seen concussions over time compared to what Michael sees now, how important were they then, and what did they do about concussions? And then, Michael, you can take it and bring us forward.
I can tell you one thing that I used to do is if I had a football player and he had a concussion and he couldn't answer some of the questions that I was asking him, I would take his football helmet. Because otherwise, they just run back into the game. And we know that multiple concussions can lead to major problems down the road, memory loss, that sort of thing. In fact, I have a friend now that played professional football and has Parkinson's. And, of course, they're relating Parkinson's and long-term traumas to some of these head injury problems.
My wife still accuses me that head injury still bother me.
And it might be. You never know.
Well, do you think it is, Woody? Do you have any?
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
With three concussions, that's quite a bit of wrecking.
Even worse than that is boxing, though. You know, when you think about the boxers and how much hitting they take to the head. Muhammad Ali is one that we think about. You know,
she mentioned taking the helmet away from the player. I know our trainers now have the authority. If they don't want a kid to go back in the game, the coach cannot override. If the trainer says he's not to go back in the game, that's a rule. We don't allow him back in.
Yeah, I'm not sure about Division II or III, but I know in Division I, they passed a rule two or three seasons ago to where if they have any symptoms or any signs of a concussion, they're done for that day. Right. Practice or game, championship, doesn't matter. So you've got, with those sorts of rules now, you've got some ammunition behind you so that when you do say this person has a concussion, then everyone knows, well, this is the process you're going to take. They're shut down for the day. We'll continue our evaluations, and then we're going to work towards some sort of gradual return to play once we deem them over those signs and symptoms of that brain trauma.
Do you face much resistance from the levels ahead?
Again, like you said, because of the media and because of what we're seeing, you know, I just showed my class. I teach the prevention and care class for the coaching majors at ULR. I just had them watch the Frontline episode on the NFL, their troubles with that. And I think now there's just, you just have to take it much more seriously because you do have that, you still have that influence of wanting to get back out there, shake it off, and that is still a little bit present. But and sometimes it's not just necessarily coaches. I think sometimes athletes have that competitive spirit at lots of different levels. I mean, that they just want to be competitive, and so they want to try and do that. So I think we've come much better at, if a student athlete's not giving us all the signs and symptoms, we can see some outward things that we never maybe didn't really pay attention to before in conjunction with that. Because a lot of times we had to rely on answering questions or, do you have a headache, feeling nauseous? Well, it's easy to say, no, I'm fine. You know, so that's where you have to get into the asking the right questions, doing a sequence of things evaluation-wise to make sure that we are identifying this issue.
And it's also good if you have the athletes, you educate the athletes. If you see one of your team members not acting appropriately, please let us know because that could be their, you know, safety in terms of not having a long-term injury.
Woody?
I mentioned Terry DeWitt a while ago who started our program, our athletic training academic program here at Henderson. He's over at Wichita now. He has done several seminars down here to the area schools, coaches, I guess anybody that's interested, administrators, but I know he's done them here in Arkadelphia, at Gurdon, at Prescott, at Malvern, specifically on head injuries. And I'm sure the whole thing, you know, it's all about education. The more we know about it, the more we're able to do research on them, and you can share that information, that educational research, the better we're going to be at handling those kind of situations.
Let me diverge just a little bit from the main topic here and ask Sue Carver about the female end of sports injuries. Is it much different than the male end of sports injuries?
Well, I think early on you didn't see the training, the conditioning in women that you saw in men. And because of body build, you may have seen different types of injuries. Like for women, I think in basketball, ACL, anterior cruciate ligament injuries was a big one. And sometimes that is geared towards technique, conditioning, and sometimes how anatomically that knee is formed, where it may predispose the ligament to being injured more. But I think most of your injuries are similar. We don't see as many head injuries because we're not in contact sports that much. you could accidentally have something happen, you know, on the field, like playing field hockey or somebody colliding with another person by accident. But, you know, we're not. Well, I guess women are boxing now.
Michael, what are you seeing at UALR here for the women's sports?
You definitely see that ACL occurrence, basketball for sure, also in soccer, volleyball. They've done, I think in the late 90s, some clinics came and saw that there was a lot of inappropriate landing techniques by a lot of female. That's, because, again, they didn't get the full spectrum of aid training that some of their male counterparts were getting. I know that when I first started at ULR in 2000, I'd watch a young lady jump great, but then she'd land and be like, man, no wonder your knee hurts, you know, because they're collapsing. They're not receiving the ground. They haven't received it. Once we took them through appropriate mechanical adjustments there and also through strength conditioning, you know, we're doing a lot better. Now, there's also still a lot of research. They do a lot of research into the female phenomenon of ACL tears, and they're seeing some correlation with hormone.
Femoral notch.
Yeah, the angle of hips. I mean, there's a lot of different things, that a lot of research. So some of that may still be a prevalency with females. But also, too, athletic trainers started becoming much more working with female populations towards the late 90s, so they started getting reported more. So it's that thing of, well, was there a lot, or was it just there's an increase because they're finally being reported?
Well, now you're taking me back to Dr. Jolly's time. Woody Jolly, when do you remember seeing women come into athletics and the injuries that you might have seen for them?
Well, we didn't have athletics for women when I was in school. They didn't play volleyball or basketball or any of that. They did, I think, some in the summer in AAU. But I saw it, the transition from when I started back in 65 coaching in junior high, I saw how the girls' athletics progressed from being, you know, where we started out in the Little Rock School District. I know they played volleyball first, and they had a little gymnastics, and they ran track. And now it's expanded where they have, of course, the softball and basketball and tennis and golf and all of those sports that Title IX has required us to do. But it's one interesting thing that I think that'll, it's kind of amusing. I remember in junior high meet back in the 60s, we used to have huge meets over at Scott Field in Little Rock, and we'd have the field be covered up with athletes. We'd run junior high girls, junior high boys, senior high girls, and senior high boys. And I remember lining up to run the 400-yard dash. That's what we ran, 440-yard dash one time. And I was a starter, and I looked down there, and there was a little junior high girl, obviously very pregnant. And I thought, my gosh, I can't believe this. Surely her coach knows this. But we shot the gun. Of course, everybody kind of laughed about it. She won the race. And it shocked everybody. But that's kind of where we've come in terms of girls training and being able to recognize what they can do from a physical standpoint. And
I bet they're just as tough as the guys, right, Sue?
They were. In fact, I've coached a few girls from time to time, and I love their attitude about, you know, just – they're such workaholics. They'll do anything. They're not many prima donnas, and they'll do whatever you ask them to do.
Well, you know, it was pretty interesting because back in the early days, they thought women were going to hurt their internal organs, and they limited what they could do. I can remember I played that basketball where you had rovers, and you couldn't cross the center line until I went to college, and then we went to a five-player game. And it's amazing how women's sports have changed. I mean, you watch Diana Nyad and swim from Cuba to Florida. You know, women are capable of really doing amazing things from an athletic standpoint.
I want to take the discussion a little bit into the I guess you'd say, the pharmacological aspect of injuries. The one that comes to my mind, I kept hearing over my decades anyway, was they give him a shot of cortisone and he got back in the game, or he was able to play the next week. How do drugs fit into what your memory is of sports injury?
I never received any kind of shots, you know, cortisone shots. I know some people did, I think, but I never had any of those, and never had any that were associated with any of the athletes that I coached. They may have got them on the side that I didn't know about, but we didn't. I don't know of any of those.
Sue?
Yes, I'm aware of people getting cortisone shots, and cortisone can be very beneficial because it can help decrease the inflammation in an area and help you heal a little bit more quickly. But the problem with it is, because it masks pain, if you do an injection and then have someone go out and participate, it also weakens protein tissue, so you have the likelihood of a rupture of a ligament or a tendon, and so then it becomes questionable about the use. Mm-hmm. I see it particularly in runners that want to continue to run that have plantar fasciitis. They'll go and get a cortisone injection and continue to run. Well, they're really putting themselves at risk for having a rupture.
Well, Michael, can you guys recognize, or is it a part of the practice of a trainer to recommend cortisone or any other thing? I don't really know the other ones that might be available.
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, my license is signed by our team physician, and so I'm providing care through his direction. And so it's up to the team physician to determine whether or not that's an appropriate therapy. Most of the time, I'd say our doctors are usually going to try something over-the-counter first, then some sort of prescription anti-inflammatory. And when all those other things, all those other treatments, modalities, and medicines over-the-counter or prescription have failed, then we may look into a possible injection of some kind, whether it's cortisone or something else. There's some other things on the market for, you know, cartilage regeneration and things of that nature that are showing some promise. So those are kind of a last ditch thing. Well, I will say this, those few people who have received maybe that type of a treatment have usually been correspond with days off.
So right, if, exactly.
If, you know, yeah. And maybe back, you know, you go back a ways when this first started. Yeah, going back, you feel great going back out there. Now it's like, no, I'm going to give you this, but you're done for 2 days. You're resting for 2 days.
Right.
You're resting for 3 days. You're, you know, or I'm going to put them on a 12-day, say, prednisone pack to get the same benefit as that shot.
Right.
But over that 12 days, you're not going to practice, but you are going to do rehab, treatment, therapy, things of that nature, so that when you get done with that treatment, you're in a much better state versus just rushing back out there like Sue was talking
right.
about. So that's kind of where we're at. Those sorts of things are definitely now. I'm not sure, you know, I can only speak for our program, and that's how we, mm-hmm. you know, we try to do things is go along kind of a stepwise thing and not just rush to that most aggressive type of treatment.
Well, Woody Jolly, let me ask you a kind of a sticky wicket question about sports injuries. And I guess lurking in the back of my mind over watching all kinds of championship games and big seasons for baseball and football and basketball, when a star athlete, I guess even on a college level, I don't think it really pertains to high school much at all, but when the important players are playing with injuries, I mean, we as fans know that so-and-so has a something or other. Where are the pressures as a coach to try and keep that all-powerful person in the game?
Well, like I said, I think the rules, particularly on college level, now Division II, Division I, I don't know about Division III, but the trainer has the authority to say whether a kid can play or not. And a trainer, as much as more so than the coach, knows whether a guy is hurt and does not need to be in the game. And with that kind of authority, I can't see it happening. I'm sure it probably does in some cases, maybe where coach has a lot of authority over the trainer in terms of hiring and firing him, but I still think that he'd be jeopardizing his job if he overruled a trainer and put a guy in that the trainer, when the trainer said he's not ready, doesn't need to be in the game. So I'm not sure. I'd like to share an interesting
sure.
story to you that I think is funny. That back in most of you know who Keith Jackson is, that does the Razorback games, played for Oklahoma. He was at Parkview when I was coaching there. Of course, an outstanding athlete, the best athlete I've ever coached in my life. His senior year, we were undefeated and getting ready to play Little Rock Central, who was undefeated at the same time. And we played Pine Bluff the week before, and he got his shoulder dislocated. We called it knockdown. We took him to the doctor, and they x-rayed it, and they, you know, said that it was probably needed to stay out for 2 or 3 weeks. Of course, we're getting ready to play. They're undefeated. We're undefeated, and we got to have him. And Ken Turner was recruiting him big time at Fayetteville at the time, and he said, Woody, I don't know whether it'll help or not, but you might try something. And this was like Tuesday or Wednesday before we played on Friday night. He said there's a chiropractor there named Terry Simmons that does acupuncture. And he said, you might take him over there and just see what he might could do. Well, I'm telling you, Keith could not raise his arm barely above his waist. And we're talking about our, you know, we got to have him. We're going to win that game, so we're desperate. I take him over there to Terry, and he x-rays him and looks at it. He says, well, let's try. It won't hurt. We'll try acupuncture. And I don't know if you've ever seen that before, but it was quite amazing to me and scary for Keith, his big old eyes rolling around as that guy was putting those needles in his arm. He hooked some little electrodes up to those needles, and, of course, no pain, no blood or anything. And we were there for about 30, 45 minutes. He pulled those needles out, and you would have to have been there to see it. It was just like Oral Roberts had laid hands on that shoulder. He could raise his arm up above his head. He swung it around like it was just like a miracle had happened right in front of me. Of course, I still don't know how it works, how that acupuncture works, but it was absolutely, Keith and I both were amazing. Played Friday night, and he scored 2 touchdowns, and we won.
How was his shoulder?
His shoulder, well, it was well enough that we felt comfortable letting him play. He didn't hurt it or anything, and he went on and played the rest of the season. I don't think he's had any more trouble with his shoulder. But that was a funny story, I thought, that a lot of people would just gasp when I tell them that and say, I don't believe that acupuncture stuff works. Well, I saw it work for real.
You really take us into the idea of what's available for sports injuries, alternative, if that's what you want to call it. Any thoughts on that, you guys?
I mean, there's so much more education and different types of treatments you can do today that was not available early on. I mean, we were just talking about PRP, which is a plasma-rich protein that they're using now to heal tendon injuries. And pretty soon we're going to be seeing stem cells for regeneration of cartilage. And I've had acupuncture before. It's very effective. So, I mean, there's just a lot of different types of therapies that can be effective in helping with the healing process.
Woody, let me thank you so much for being with us here.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I'll give a little bit of an opposite. For me, I've really focused currently in our treatment protocols really based on what's called clinical-based approach. And so for me, I actually didn't start off in athletic training. I started off in aerospace engineering. And so I got to have some pretty hardcore science before I start applying a treatment or a therapy to someone. But that's my kind of my own thing. And that's been a big growing thing I know in research is that you have what you're doing has to have some sort of evidence-based. It's got to have some rationale to it, and it needs to have empirical reviewed. So that's usually where we focus on in our athletic training room. If someone wants to go after some sort of alternative, then they're free to do that. By no means am I going to stand in the way of doing that. But for us, where we're at, we're going to stick to those clinical base because that's going to keep us, you know, protected from one way, but also know that we're applying the best science and, you know, the best protocols that we can.
I don't think it's a new term applied to sports injuries, but it's maybe relatively new, and that is the term sports medicine. And of course, UAMS here has the sports medicine facility. I had never been there, and I never had need to know it from a personal standpoint. But sports medicine, what does that mean, Sue Carver?
Well, I mean, it's treating injuries, particularly sports injuries, specific to sports injuries. But it is, as he said, using the clinical research and applying that clinical research to treat the injuries. There are other options out there. Not only are there the high school college athletes, which is what he's dealing with, but you have your recreational athletes that are out there.
Is that what you see it?
We see, well, I do geriatric sports medicine now because I work at...
Oh, cool.
Well, I call it geriatric sports medicine, but I work in the senior center at UAMS, and it's amazing what, if people continue to train and exercise and work out, how active they can be in their later years. And so we really encourage all of our people, if they come in with injuries, once we get them on a program, we say, you don't stop once you feel better. This is a lifetime thing.
I'm glad you mentioned that about the geriatrics. My dad's 88 years old, and all his life long, as I've been with him, he keeps telling me about his knees because he got him hurt playing high school football.
Right.
He's an older person. I guess I'm asking you now, and you're dealing with much older people.
Right.
Do you hear the stories like my dad's? Oh, I got hurt in high school this or college that.
Oh, yeah, sure. And because of what you see a lot is the degenerative joint disease, the osteoarthritis. I've had injuries from when I played college sports, and I've had a total knee replacement since then. But so those are the types of things that we're seeing is people that have had either traumas that have gotten worse because of osteoarthritis, because most of us develop some degenerative changes in our joints anyway. I find a lot of times those people that think they have to have surgery right away can delay that surgery or maybe avoid the surgery by getting on a good exercise program, what we call prehab. You know, to prepare them, they go and they think they're going to have surgery. And I tell them it's much easier to rehabilitate first. And even if you have to have surgery, you're going to recover a lot faster if you're stronger.
Well, Michael Switlick, do you guys as trainers recognize injuries that could be long-term problems for people? And how do you handle that?
Well, absolutely. You know, it's all about the initial care that we give them now. You know, it's about recognizing what we need to do now to make sure they're returned to play to a certain level so that we're not putting them back maybe too soon. You know, that whole discussion of what you're talking about, that star player that needs to get back out there. That's what sports medicine's about. You've got, to me, you got your general practice, your general medicine, which is great, but you've got, you know, sports medicine kind of diverges from that, and it pushes that envelope a little bit of what can we do and how soon can we get them back out there on the field. So you need to make sure that what you're doing is the appropriate approach for that person so that you try to minimize those long-term. Any kind of traumatic injury, you're probably already starting the clock as far as degenerative changes. Right. It's already happened.
Right.
But the big thing is can we help with the restorative powers of the body to try to minimize that as much as possible. There's a young lady that's rehabbing with us right now. She actually was monitoring her range of motion the other day, and her other knee, she'd had an ACL on her other leg that she'd already been released from, already playing on. We're rehabbing her other leg. She just recently tore ACL, and we went to see if she had enough symmetry, and her other leg hadn't even regained full range of motion. She'd been cleared to go back to play without even having full range of motion in the other leg. So that's something that I feel like now we got to try and work on so that she doesn't have those future, you know, try to stave off those future, you know, issues if we can by making sure that we gain all that full range of motion back and making sure that. So when I saw that was kind of a little disconcerting that she'd been running around playing on a leg that supposedly was, but you cleared, saw that lack of range of motion. Yeah.
Well, you know, in physical therapy, it's a little bit different because, you know, you're limited by the number of visits that the insurance company will give the person. And so a lot of times what we find is we have to discharge them just at the point where we could really be doing some things with them. You know, you got their strength level up a little bit. Now we need to work some agility and do some other things like that. But we don't have any visits left. So it's a little bit different when you're in athletic training setting. You've got an captive audience right there. Your coaches are going to let you see the athletes as much as you want. When I got out of school, my first job was at the University of Tennessee. I was the first full-time women's trainer at Tennessee. And one of the things that I did was I actually tested all the athletes. I did range of motion tests. I did isokinetic testing on different joints, depending on the sport that they were on, and then put them on, went to the coaches and said, these are the deficits that I see, and we need to get these kids in condition. They didn't have conditioning coaches, you know, strength training coaches at that time. They later did get strength training coaches, but it was up to the trainer to make sure that they were in good shape. And I might do an agility test on them. So if they got injured, I would have times on them of how they did this agility test. So when they had to go back and be within a certain percentage of that before they could go back to play. So those are some of the things that you can do to really go to the coach and say, this is why they're not back at play. They have to be able to do this on the agility test before they can go back.
Well, Michael Swidlick, let me ask you, in dealing with the college athletes right now, but the bad news time, when you've had an athlete who has suffered injury that is really career-ending to that sport, how do you handle that?
Honesty. You just got to be up front with them. There's no way of trying to, I guess for lack of a better phrase, sugarcoat or make it simple. You just got to be up front and do your best to show, you know, I mean, there's compassion, but then there's empathy. And so you just got to be able to provide that balance there of being honest, but yet not too, you know, overly, you know, emotional about it yourself. You got to kind of be that pillar for them because it's going to obviously affect them emotionally. But you just got to be honest with them. Here are the results. Here's what's happened, and this is what we're going to do to get better at it. And yes, it's going to affect the end of your season or possibly a career. You know, and so it's not easy. And a lot of times too, when you're talking about season ending, isn't as hard, I don't think, as talking about career. Either case or in both, you're more than likely need to also rely on your medical staff. So a lot of times we're having those discussions, it's as a group. You know, our team physician's involved, I'm involved, coaches involved, parents know. And so it's a group kind of discussion versus it just being a one-on-one thing where it's just dropped on that student athlete. They're like, now what? So, you know, that way you've got that support network in place.
Mm-hmm. Well, going back to what I said at the very outset of the program of John Allen Adams, who became a quadriplegic in 1936 and spent the rest of his life in a wheelchair. What is different from an athlete who hears a story from you that, or you guys, that their career is over, and they ask about all the changes that have happened since his time in 1936, especially in paralysis, to now? Do they not ask you, what's new? What's the latest? What can we do?
for his situation, just to use that, just to kind of start that discussion, is that, you know, our on-field management is so much different than what he experienced. If we see someone who's gone down with that type of cervical or head injury, I mean, everyone knows that, that you're going to treat this by stabilizing the spine. We're not moving them until we've assessed them. And, we've got a protocol in place that we're going to handle this a certain way to minimize any kind of future damage.
Can you tell that right away when they're on the field that that's the injury that they've gotten? Is it an immediate alarm?
Well, if you suspect it, you're going to assess and treat it as if it's a potential spine injury.
Yeah, you
don't want to take a chance with it.
I had a paramedic that taught our EMT class at Arkansas that said, if you suspect a head injury, suspect a spine injury or cervical injury. If you suspect a cervical injury, suspect a head injury. So you're going under, well, I know assuming things isn't always the best thing to do, but in that situation, you're going in with worst case scenario. We're going to treat them. I mean, how many times you see NFL or professional players being hauled off on a stretcher because of the fact that we just want to make sure that we're going to do this the right way to minimize the chances of any kind of, you know, having what happened to that gentleman on the field, having him sit up maybe too soon or something of that nature. It's amazing how just starting on the field the right way can help prevent some of that that really extreme damage. Now, sometimes it's already taken place.
Right.
But there's times, though, if that's not managed appropriately back then at that time, you didn't know to, you know, put somebody on a board or how to roll them appropriately.
Right.
It's amazing. You know, again, the care that we can provide now, Sue and I, is also keeping up with technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you didn't have the ability to have a board, a lightweight board that you
could
roll.
Well, you got an ambulance right there,
and
they're taking them immediately to the hospital, doing the x-rays and doing the management for them. And if you can, a lot of times, if they do have an injury, controlling the swelling can make a big difference in their recovery. I mean, there's things they can do now that they couldn't do back then.
And if the damage is already done, I just got to go look at the greatest contrast to the scenario you're bringing to us is the gentleman that at Rutgers that had his bed. Look at his quality of life is greatly probably drastic to that gentleman because that damage was done. But it was managed appropriately on the field and afterwards in the hospital and things. And look at him now. He's in a chair that allows him to get away wherever he wants.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the ability to communicate. He's got the ability to finish college. I mean, the technology for people who've suffered that kind of catastrophic event is so much better than it was in 1936.
Right.
So, again, it's amazing what we're able to provide from a treatment standpoint for that extreme case. Now, if you're looking at someone who's broken their tibia completely, you know, again, you go back to the 70s or so, I'm not sure when, but that was still debilitating. I mean, up to a certain point, you know, now we've got certain surgeries because of technology, surgical procedures and stuff. There's certain things now that we can get over, but then there's still things lagging behind. You damage your cartilage to a certain point and it's only going to regrow so much.
Right. You know? Do you remember when they used to think that the best thing to do after surgery on a knee was to put it in a cast immobilizer?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then they found they couldn't bend the knee again. So guess what?
Yeah.
You now have passive range of motion machines moving your knee immediately after surgery.
Yeah. And I even remember that with ankle. I remember when I first got an athletic training, you know, we had an ankle sprain. They went into a cast or some sort of and non-weight bearing for like weeks on end. Well, then the NBA decided to do a study in the 90s about ankle sprains in the NBA because it was pretty prominent.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they found actually the sooner weight bearing that you could do, the faster they got over it. So even some of those principles, some of those things that we were actually almost too conservative on was too conservative. We found we were too conservative on some things.
It sounds like you're saying
more progressive.
It sounds like you're saying the coach would say, get back in the game.
And that might have been actually the right, there might have been some truth to that.
Well,
maybe,
and we're finding that sometimes there's a medium halfway between
conservative.
And
big difference between being able to bear weight and walk normally versus going back and out and running and up and down the court or something.
But I think, one of the biggest changes that I've seen is the prevention of heat stroke. And that's a purely preventable type injury, and it led to many deaths. Just the fact that now we know athletes perform better with water. We need to give them water. It doesn't mean they're sissies if they drink water on the sideline. So we're trying to pump the water. And
Dr. Jolly makes a great point in the fact that there is a climatization difference between our generation now and when he was in, because again, there wasn't air conditioning or wasn't prominent, you know, in your schools. There wasn't the video game. I kind of blame it on the video games a little bit.
The fact that
we're highly distracted indoors now, where it used to be our entertainment was outdoors.
Mm-hmm.
You got outside in the summer. I mean, how many people for so many generations went in the summertime outdoors and worked? I mean, you turned 16, you had a job outside, right? Construction, whatever it was. My dad always talks about going baling hay in the summer. Him and his brothers would go out into the fields of Kansas
and
bale hay.
Yeah. Exactly.
So when football started, it was easy. That was easy. You know, working in a barn in the middle of summer in Kansas, that was hard, you know? So I think there is that different level. And two, jobs have changed. That's not even where your job is anymore. If you did get a job, a lot of them do, it's indoors again. You know, you're working indoors. You're working at a convenience store or a restaurant or something of that nature. So you're not getting exposed to those elements.
So you're saying we are sissies.
That's what it sounds like.
I think it is acclimatization. Right, I think the point of acclimatization is really important sometimes. Now, that being said, again, we got to make sure, though, that hydration is established. Because, again, we know that you get dehydrated to even a couple percentages of your body weight can have a drastic impact, not just on your health, but performance.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I'll bring up the fact that in 1985, that's when the National Athletic Trainers Association first did their National High School Injury Registry. And they did it with football players. They took 105 high schools and they surveyed them and found out, and from that they projected what the injury rate would be nationally for football players. And they projected 636,000 injuries nationally in football, with 65% of those occurring in practice.
Really?
Yes.
This is one season?
This is one. That's what they calculated for a year for the injuries nationwide. They went back and did another one in 1995. And what they were trying, I mean, this was the big push to try and get athletic trainers in high school. And the biggest problem with that was that financially, they said they couldn't afford to hire an athletic trainer. So in 1985, they reinstated it, and they added some other sports. But then what they did was projected the football injuries again, and it was lower. It was about 506,452, with about two-thirds of the injuries occurring in practice. At that time, less than 10% of the high schools had athletic trainers in the schools. Then in 1998, there was a letter printed in USA Today following the death of two Kansas football players. And the letter outlined the fact that in collegiate and professional sports, there was at least one athletic trainer for every 25 college and professional sports. And in high schools, there was one athletic trainer for every 5,000 athletes.
Wow.
And so the writer stated, if the school districts feel they cannot justify the full-time employment of a qualified healthcare professional, can they justify letting students play the game? And that was a lot of free publicity for the NATA and was a big push for getting athletic trainers in the high school.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just got back from Virginia, and my niece is 10 years old, and she's a cheerleader. And we went to the football game. These kids were in full pads, playing on AstroTurf for, you know, regular schedule with timeouts in 91-degree temperature with no athletic trainer. I mean, they were hitting and... It's amazing that we can spend that kind of money on equipment and football, but we can't spend it on having one medical person out on the field.
Michael?
On that, you know, that's always tough for us in the collegiate setting. You know, we're always concerned about staff because we want to make sure we're providing that adequate coverage to all our events.
Right.
So that's always – that seems like it's always on the list of things to make sure that we're doing appropriately, is making sure that we are providing the adequate coverage, because we can't necessarily be with even my staff and having 14 to 15 NCAA Division I sports. It's extremely difficult to be at every single event, you know, every single practice. So you really have to work on your risk management skills and making sure resources are placed in the right places at the right times each day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's every day, week, month, you know, and year. And so there's a lot of strategizing that goes on. But again, at the same time, trying to be progressive in adding staff when we feel that we can financially, but also when we can from a need standpoint. And that's always tough too. I mean, trying to show that value. I haven't been in that secondary school setting in a while, so I it's hard for me to provide too much commentary on it. But at the same time, I think it is something that is worthy of note, that we need to be able to, you know, which is worse, having those horrible injuries that may result in catastrophic things, or having the right personnel there that can help minimize that. So I don't think you can put a dollar figure on that. And I don't think it would be too terribly difficult if you really sat down and made it a priority to find someone. We have graduates out there. Just in our state alone, there's 7 or 8.
Is it a good field to go into?
I think it's a very good field to go into. Mm-hmm. And it's evolved. I mean, you're seeing athletic trainers in workplaces now, because they're seeing that if they can keep their – if they have – workers with injuries, and they can keep them right there and do their treatments.
Well, and workers want to get back to work too. Yeah. I mean, these guys, if they don't do their shift, there's someone wanting to take it.
You know,
from what I understand. So, I mean, they almost want to be treated like the athlete. They want to do something that gets them back on the line, because if they're gone for too long, there's someone ready to take it.
You're seeing physician extenders in hospitals, not in very many of them, but I think in Texas you're seeing physician extenders working in, like, the emergency rooms and handling sprains and strains and not the major stuff there. You're seeing athletic trainers in fitness centers. You're also seeing physical therapists in fitness centers, because a lot of times the people that are there want somebody in case they get injured. So they just put a room and have a licensed therapist there or a licensed
athletic
trainer.
Or, I've been injured, how do I get fixed up?
Where do I get the help?
And there's something to be said, too, about being fit. You know, we've always said if you're fit and strong, you got a good chance of, one, preventing the injury, or two, bouncing back. Like she was talking about prehab, was that you can bounce back from it a little bit faster if you're fit, strong, and in shape. There is kind of that combined health component to that fitness.
I have a friend of mine that's he's 62 years old, and he's a physical therapist, and he's always lifted weights, and he said, yes, I pay for my health insurance every day. I work out.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about sports injuries here today on Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. I do want to thank my guest for being with me here today, Dr. Woody Jolly, a professor at Henderson State University, where he played through 1960 through 1964. Sue Carver has been here with me from the middle generation perspective. Sue Carver is a physical therapist here at UAMS. Sue, thanks for being with us here today. And then also from the younger generation perspective, Michael Switlick. He's a certified athletic trainer here at UALR. He's the head athletic trainer for men's basketball, cross country, track and field, and both golf teams. Michael, thanks for being here today.
Again, my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Folks, if you happen to have a student in high school who's playing in athletics and you've been worried about them getting injured, I think after listening to this program today, you probably are aware of the fact that training and physical training and trainers and the coaches are well aware of the hazards with those sports, and they're not going to take your kids into areas they shouldn't as far as sports injuries are concerned. And if they do happen to get injured, sounds like there's quite a bit out there. Again, thanks for listening to the program today. You can catch the longer version at our website at kuar.org. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow is a production of KUAR Public Radio, Little Rock.